Well, hello, faithful listener, and welcome to the Small Voice podcast for April. My name is Darren, and joining me remotely, safe in their own homes, are Anne.
Hello.
And Holly.
Hello.
Don't ask me how all this works technically. I think it's something to do with tin cans and a very long bit of string along the M8. But be that as it may, we're delighted, nay enchanted, nay fair buzzing that you've joined us once again for another hour of podcasty goodness full of musings and matters moral, ethical and spiritual. This month in our media review, we'll be bringing you our pick of the best things to keep those isolation blues away. Margaret will be catching up with some old friends in our Small Voice of the Month feature. Friend of the show and self-confessed bad Christian, Dave Tomlinson, will be Anne's guest in 1,000 words. And we'll be looking back over Lent and Easter in a low-key moral mixdown. Plus music with tunes from Sally Simpson and a sneak preview of the latest single from the Ayoub Sisters. How will we fit it all in? But before all that, it's time for our heaven and hell health check, which is a bit of a challenge these days, what with one thing and another, but needs must. So, Anne, if I can ask the question, how's it been?
Well, given that we've just come through Easter Sunday, I would guess that I would say there have been moments of joy since we were last together, but all of it against a kind of background of low-level anxiety about the people I love who are vulnerable. My sister has asthma. My niece is a nurse who's looking after COVID patients. And Holly's a doctor, as are another half dozen of our friends. And so I think that's always there in the background.
Yeah. And Holly, what about you?
So I guess very similar to Anne, quite a lot of anxiety. I've been working in a hospital this week and caring for COVID patients. And there's obviously quite a lot of stress that comes with that, and it's been quite challenging. But I have to say that there have been moments of immense joy within that and alongside that. And one thing that has really struck me about this period of social distancing and isolation is that the moments of heaven have been so mundane and ordinary and so wonderful. So I am finding joy in smaller places, and I think there's a lot of good to be said about that.
I mean, I think I'm in the same situation. Definitely there's low level stress, and I am doing my best to withdraw from social media, you know, once a day, check the Guardian website and try not to get too upset. And I must apologize, I forgot I was gonna have a Trump bucket, and I was just going to drop about £40 worth of coins in there for the idiot that is that man. But we shall move on and not talk. If anything's hell, it's certainly having to put up with that man. So yeah, there you go. I've brought things down to a low level, but hey, I think that's why I got the gig. Okay, before we move on, a quick hello to those who took the time to post comments or get in touch via social media. We always appreciate that. Thanks. So Holly, you've got some feedback, haven't you?
Yeah, well, quite a few of you got in touch about our Lent and Holy Week podcast extras, and indeed our recent lockdown podcast extra. But a special panda greeting goes to our new listener, Paul, who gave us some lovely feedback on our Good Friday podcast extra. And also to Coralie, who got in touch on Easter Sunday to let us know that she was listening to our Easter thoughts and wishes us all a happy Easter.
Yeah, that's great.
Dr. Beth also got in touch on Easter Sunday, Holly, to say that she had listened to the Easter podcast that morning before church and had done a bit of research on the painter that we mentioned, Caspar David Friedrich. She hadn't come across him before, but she found this quote from him, which I thought was very apt. The painter should paint not only what he has in front of him, but also what he sees inside himself. So thank you for that, Dr. Beth.
We do always love to hear your comments and feedbacks on the items we discuss. So please, faithful listener, do get in touch to say hello via our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or on Twitter at @small_voice1. So first up, as ever, it's our media review. Holly, what are we taking a look at this month?
So with the news that the lockdown in the UK will be extended by at least another 3 weeks, we thought we would take this opportunity to share with you some lockdown recommendations to help keep us all sane, or as sane as possible during this extended period of social distancing. I'm really excited to hear what recommendations you both have for us. So what has been keeping you sane, Anne?
Well, now, I think I can say with some confidence that apart from our producer, Jill, who knows what I've chosen, there is nobody who would predict that I'm about to utter the following words. My recommendation is the official video for the Icelandic entry to the Eurovision Song Contest. Have either of you seen it?
See, I had Belarus, you know. Okay, do tell.
The English title of the song is Think About Things, and it's by someone. Now, even I can't even say their name because I think the guy's name is Daddy or Dali. I suspect it's an Icelandic sound that doesn't exist in English, halfway between a D and an L. So he's Daddy or Dali, and the name of his group in English is Data Plan. Okay, so far, so completely impenetrable. However, the words of the song in English are glorious. It starts like this: Baby, I can't wait to know. Believe me, I'll always be there. So though I know I love you, I find it hard to see how you feel about me. But when you realize he's talking about his 10-month-old son and waiting to find out what his 10-month-old son, when he can speak, will think about his parents, it puts a whole new gloss on the words. They are absolutely wonderful. But much as I like the song, which is kind of neo-disco, now remember, I'm kind of ancient disco. That was my era, 70s.
I don't think I've ever heard the phrase neo-disco.
I may have just coined it, Holly. But I think
a nation
kind
reaches
of,
for Wikipedia. Sorry.
I think it is ironic postmodern disco. But so apart from the fact that the musical genre really appeals to me, what makes it so utterly, utterly, utterly wonderful is the official video. Which let me kind of try and sum it up. They set the performance in a house in Iceland at a family party where the children have been asked to get up and do a party piece. So the video opens with a wee girl of about 7 or 8 playing the recorder. And then she sits down and then the group get up to do their thing. And it is just wonderful. They perform the most nerdy dance you have ever seen in your life. I loved it so much that I persuaded my niece to teach the whole family it because she's doing daily Keep Fit classes on Zoom at 4 o'clock. So she's learned it, she's taught us all it, and it's my dream that before this thing is over, we will all perform it together on Zoom. It's kind of line dancey, Darren. I don't know if you're into line. I know you're into tango.
No, I was going to say, we're going to have to post that on our website, Anne. You're going to have to be recorded doing that. We'll have to show the nation, surely.
I am willing to do that because it is the kind of dance. Actually, this guy, Daddy, summed it up as, it's the kind of dance that anyone is physically capable of doing, but it's actually very difficult to do. And if you try it, you'll find out that's the case. So it's based on a kind of line dancing thing. And it looks easy, but it's not. But oh, it's so utterly brilliant. And it is brilliant because it's not cool. It's not pretentious. It's not saying anything about, you know, it's the old thing, as Huey Lewis and his wonderful band once said, it's hip to be square. And it's just wonderful seeing really young people, Icelandic young people saying, just put aside all that nonsense. Who cares about any of that rubbish on social media? Just be yourselves, have fun, sing, dance, and be as joyous as you can be while we're all in this situation. I loved it.
Well, Anne, that sounds absolutely fantastic. Darren, what have you got to top that?
I can't really. I can't. No. I think Anne's knocked out the park. Well, I mean, we are talking about things to keep us sane, and it's funny because I read a lot. And, you know, if you'd said to me, OK, you're going to be on kind of enforced house arrest, how are you going to spend your time? Then I would have said, you know what, I'm going to be reading the heck out of so many books. And I don't think I'm alone in saying that actually I'm not that great at reading just now. I think I've spoken to a few other people and they're finding it hard to focus for a long time. Likewise, some TV to some extent, but sitting down to watch a long film. So. What has been keeping me sane is something which has always been important to me, which is food, but specifically cooking. Cooking and more recently baking has been keeping me sane. And what has been lovely across Twitter and social media has been to see the response that some people have made to the current crisis. Jamie Oliver put together with his production company in the space of a week, 5 days of programming for Channel 4. But then once he moved into lockdown, he's continued doing a program. Now, it's on daily on Channel 4, half an hour. Half of it is clips. But the first half is him with his family and his wife, Jules, taking the videos with the iPad and the iPhone. And it's just lovely. And BBC have just started up this week a show called Daily Kitchen, which is companion to their Saturday Kitchen. And Jack Munro, who's on Twitter, known as the Bootstrap Cook or the Tin Can Cook, is showing people how to cook on a very limited budget. So it's been great to see the responses to that. But the person that keeps me sane and the person whose words I kind of live for, you'll know that I like my Italian food, and I'm going to match Anne here because Anne once picked a newspaper column as something to feature on this show. And I'm featuring Rachel Roddy personally. This is the person I want to talk about. Rachel Roddy has a Guardian column in their Saturday Feast magazine called Tales from an Italian Kitchen. And she's also the author of a cookbook. And I'm going to hold it up so they can see it. This is actually the American edition. It should be called Five Quarters, but this is My Kitchen in Rome. And she's one of these writers, very much like Nigel Slater and Nigella Lawson, where you sit and you could happily read it even if you don't make the recipes. But if you do make the recipes, they are fabulous and they're very, very simple. If I was going to read one out to you, and I won't, don't worry, it would be called Fave e Pecorino, and it's just fava beans and pecorino, because apparently at this time of year in Rome, that's what you do. You've got fresh beans and pecorino, and you just pod the beans, get a bit of cheese, and it's, you know, heaven on a plate. And of course, Rachel Roddy, she lives in Rome, so she's been in lockdown during Rome. And I just find right now, concentrating on making decent, simple food, and also having a wee go at baking is something which is keeping me sane. And there's a wee bit of a nod there to friends, I will say friends who are very close to my heart, and they're friends who run a restaurant. I won't mention them by name, I'm sure I've mentioned them before. But I am so concerned about the food industry just now, you know, the hospitality industry. So it's a way of kind of keeping their memory alive until the next time I can get to a restaurant. So that's me. More serious than Anne, beat that.
My mouth is watering now, Darren. I actually wanted to talk about another industry that's really struggling at the moment with my recommendation. So I spent Easter Monday watching the Folk on Foot Front Room Festival. And it was an absolutely fantastic way to spend Easter Monday. So I don't know if either of you have heard of Folk on Foot.
No.
It's a podcast that's been on the go since August 2018. In each episode, broadcaster Matthew Bannister takes a walk with a folk musician in a landscape that is meaningful to them, and then they sing and play on location. It's a delightful podcast. It's well worth a listen. But what I wanted to talk to you particularly about was the wonderful Front Room Festival, which I have to say, I stumbled upon. I think Corinne Polwart had posted about it on Easter Monday, and I thought, well, that sounds like a good way to spend a day. And it started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It ran on to about 9:30. The festival featured artists in Scotland, like Corinne, who I mentioned, and from across the UK. So up north to Julie Fowlis, to Peggy Seeger in her front room near Oxford, I think she lives, and Seth Lakeman. Each played a 30-minute set in their own homes, and it was interspersed with wee bits of chat. They were stitched together to be broadcast on YouTube. And there was a GoFundMe for the podcast. So you can watch the video without having contributed to the GoFundMe. But if you contribute to the festival, 50% of the proceeds go to the charity Help Musicians UK, which helps musicians in hardship. And as you will know, a lot of musicians have had gigs cancelled and their livelihoods are really threatened at the moment. And the other half of the proceeds were split between the musicians who contributed to the festival to make up for some of their lost earnings during this really difficult time. I have to say, I've never been to a festival in my house before. I had to cook my own lunch. But I also got to sit and listen to Peggy Seeger singing children's songs from her childhood and teaching little rounds. And she'd produced a lyric sheet to go with her set so that everybody could sing along. There was a wonderful hashtag on Twitter, hashtag Front Room Fest, where people were setting up tents in their back garden, sitting with a beer on their sofa, and really felt like a sense of community. There was even a virtual merch tent where you could go and support the musicians by buying some of their wares. I would thoroughly recommend anyone who is interested in folk music from throughout these islands to go and have a wee look at the, it's available on YouTube and will be for some time. Last I looked, they were up to having raised nearly £100,000 for musicians, which is a fantastic feat. So we think we've run the gamut of selection of different different things for all tastes. Anne, where can we find the neo-disco Icelandic Eurovision entry?
Euro pigeon,
exactly.
There are lots of versions of it available on the internet, but I want you to have the full official video experience. So what I'd like you to do is to go and have a look at our website, which is smallvoice.org.uk, where I will paste the official video's YouTube link.
And Darren, where can we find some of your recommendations?
Well, Rachel Roddy, as I mentioned, writes every Saturday in The Guardian in their rather lovely Feast magazine. And she's also got two books of cooking. One is called Five Quarters and the other is called Two Kitchens. So there you go. Someone who likes numbers. Maybe that's why I like her so much. And just like Anne, we'll put the links on the website.
And Folk on Foot have produced a compilation of some of the highlights from the Folk on Foot Festival, which is available wherever you find your podcasts. We can find them on Twitter or Facebook at Folk on Foot. And I would recommend having a wee look at the hashtag Front Room Fest.
Now for some music. We're delighted that the Ayoub sisters, Sarah and Laura, got in touch with us to see if we would play their new single, Would We Ever? The track is called Storm and is their first self-composed single. We think it's great, so have a listen. Thank you. That was the Ayoub Sisters with Storm, their new single, released on Friday, April 17th. It's available to purchase online. Check out their website for details. Time for a regular feature, A Thousand Words, where Anne talks to someone about a picture or image which means a great deal to them. Who have you got for us this month, Anne?
Well, because of the present lockdown this month, we are raiding our archive and have selected an interview we did with Dave Tomlinson. Dave describes himself as a writer, a speaker, a passionate seeker after truth and wisdom, and an avid explorer of theology, spirituality, and life in general. Dave retired almost 2 years ago now, but at the time that this interview was recorded, he was the vicar of St Luke's Anglican Church in Holloway, North London, which he described then as a glorious mishmash community of North London urbanites sharing friendship and groping after God. Dave is also an old friend of this podcast. We reviewed his book, The Bad Christian's Manifesto, back in October 2014, and Darren interviewed him in front of a live audience at the I Write Book Festival in Glasgow in 2015. So what image did Dave choose to talk about?
So this is a picture painted by a Filipino artist, and the characters are all meant to be Filipinos, and there's four people, three men and a woman, who are in what would appear to be a cafe or a wine bar, having a good time really. They look like they're in the corner of the room, laughing and joking and drinking, and it would appear that the woman is kind of holding court really, that she's sort of telling stories or jokes or whatever which is causing the men to be rolling around in laughter, and that it just is a wonderful picture of a very good time being had by all.
Where did you first come across this painting?
Well, I came across it through stumbling on something called the Jesus Laughing Exhibition, which was an exhibition of paintings commissioned by two Australian men who worked for a Christian charity travelling around the world in the course of their work, who often went into churches and realised that nearly all the images of Jesus that they saw, they felt made him look very sombre or even stern. And they felt surely Jesus laughed as well and had a good time. And so they commissioned a whole bunch of artists, mainly in the developing world, though actually I think there were six from Scotland, who were commissioned to do pictures of Jesus where he was either laughing or just in a very positive, upbeat mode, really. And so this picture is one of those. I like all of the paintings in the collection, but I like this one the best of all, partly because it's just a beautiful image and lovely colours, but also because of the subject matter that I think it's trying to convey.
What is it about this subject matter that drew you to this painting?
Well, it is a portrayal of Emmaus, you know, where Jesus, the risen Jesus, had walked on this road to Emmaus, 9 miles or so, with these two disciples who didn't recognise him. And the story in Luke is that he talked with them and he expounded the scriptures to them as they walked along the way, but they never realised who he was until they had persuaded him to come into this house or inn or whatever it was to have supper because it was late in the day.
And this was after the crucifixion.
That's right, yes. So they were full of grief and sorrow, and they poured all this grief out to Jesus, not realizing apparently who he was, which is an incredible thing in itself. But it was when they got together around a table in this house in the evening to have supper, and Jesus broke the bread and passed it round to them, that they suddenly realized who it was. So it's that story that's being represented here, but in a really rather unique way. And I think that the really special aspect of this story is that the Jesus figure is actually the woman. I looked at this picture and I thought how wonderful this is, and I wanted to use it, and I was talking to a friend about it, how I was going to use it in a service, that it was about Emmaus, and I said, I haven't quite worked out which one is Jesus yet. So my friend said, well, the woman's got holes in her hands, which is a bit of a clue. And I suddenly thought, my God, I've just fallen right into the trap, the wonderful trap of this painting, because the artist said that the problem is that Christians have such a limited concept of Jesus, and they think of him in terms of Palestine 2,000 years ago, of a man, really. And yet the point of the resurrection story is that Jesus wasn't recognised because he wasn't this same old person that they'd known, that suddenly Jesus was transcending the categories of the person that they'd known and recognised in the past. And so he's deliberately making a joke here, a joke on the person looking at the painting, by fooling you into something that you were not expecting. And of course, I fell headlong into that because I missed it altogether. And I would probably describe myself as a feminist, you know. So all of my kind of agenda would be in the direction of feeling very positive about this. And yet my own prejudice, my own expectations kicked in and I didn't realise who it was. So the picture, what I like about it so much is that it actually caught me out. And it revealed my own prejudices or expectations in coming to this particular story.
As a woman, I thought that I wasn't limited in my image of Jesus by the fact that he was a man. If you'd asked me that theoretically, right. I would have said, no, it makes no odds. I understand that he transcends all that. But then I've said he again. But when I first saw this painting, it absolutely slapped me between the eyes. Because I suddenly realised I had never envisaged Jesus as a woman, ever.
Right.
I never, ever put myself into that role. I've taken part in lots of kind of Ignatian Bible study and put myself in many roles, but never been able to think myself into that role. So for me as a woman, that's powerful. But what does it do for your image of Jesus as a man looking at that?
It's kind of, for me, not so hard to think about God as having maternal qualities and being, you know, a mother figure as well as a father figure. But of course, Jesus was a man. And so that's a confusing thing. And it's not new. I mean, people like Julian of Norwich spoke of Jesus as a woman, as a mother figure. But it is confusing because we live in a world in which we see people fitting one gender or the other. But the whole point, I think, about the Christian notion of incarnation is not that God became a man, but that God became human, that God was part of the human world and the human experience. Now, clearly, you know, he was going to be one or the other, and he appeared as a man. But the real point about the incarnation isn't that Jesus was a first century Palestinian man, but that Jesus was a human being. And therefore, I think it's important that people of every time in history and of every culture and of every experience of what it is to be human can identify with this person. It's interesting, actually, that within the collection, there's another one in which it would appear very clearly that Jesus is being portrayed as a gay man. So I think this is the important point, that God became human. And in fact, I think it's a good thing that it kind of will upset some people, and it will upset some people, because what it's doing is striking at the very heart of some of our prejudices. And it's interesting, isn't it, that that can be done sometimes much more powerfully by an image than it can be by words. You know, we could talk theologically, as I've just been doing, about the incarnation, but an image is much more powerful because it touches us at an emotional level as well as an intellectual level.
The image gets under our defences, doesn't it? Before you can employ any logic, it's made its impact.
That's right, absolutely. And actually, when my friend said, the woman's the one with the holes in her hand, my first reaction emotionally was a kind of, ooh, I was kind of thrown back by that, before my mind kicked in and I could intellectualise and say, no, of course, I've got no problem with that whatsoever. But I think the fact that it uncovered something down in me that I didn't think was there is really what I think the story of Emmaus in the Gospels is all about, because they didn't recognise him when they met him. And I think that's what the painting's saying, and that's what we need to face up to in our lives generally, that Jesus actually appears in human form all the time in our world. And it may be through a beggar on the street, or it may be through a musician singing on the stage, or someone in a film, or whoever, but I think that God is incarnated a million times in our world, over and over again. The real problem is, will we recognise him or her when we encounter them?
The wonderful Dave Tomlinson was talking about Emmaus, a painting by Emmanuel Garabet. You can see it in the context of the exhibition Jesus Laughing and Loving on the website of the Major Issues and Theology Foundation. We'll put the link on our website where you can also see the painting. Just go to www.smallvoice.org.uk.
Time now for our small voice of the month, where we feature a person or organisation that is doing something which may seem small, but yet is making a big difference. This month, Margaret has recorded a special roundup during this time of coronavirus.
If ever there was a time for small voices, I think this is it. All around, people are seeing a job needing to be done and getting on with it and doing what they can. So how could I pick just one of them? Well, I ducked out of the challenge and decided to take a look at some of the people we've featured before who are responding to a new situation. Back in July 2017, we featured Jim Estill of Guelph in Canada. Then it was Syrian refugees who needed help, and Jim's solution was to sponsor families to come to Canada and get jobs in his company and others in the town. This time it's ventilators. He's roped in other companies again and got the engineers working on how to make ventilators from parts that are available off the shelf and so they can be made quickly. One of the assembly lines has been modified to make them, and the team has created its first prototype. Of course, there's more fine-tuning to do and it needs approval of the federal government, but they will fill a possible gap as a backup version. Jim's philosophy: sitting on the couch, that doesn't fit for me, I want action. My second choice is Proof Bakery. I had a surprise delivery a couple of weeks ago of a box of sourdough bread, focaccia and ciabatta from Proof Bakery in Coventry. It turned out to be a gift from Cheryl Neo. Cheryl told me in February 2019 about this bakery that was set up by her sister in order to train refugees and asylum seekers to bake bread while learning English and other skills. The organisation has expanded its range of absolutely mouth-watering goodies, if you look at the pictures, and it's grown an extensive network of outlets with employment for some and training for many more. Right now, they're busy baking and delivering in the Coventry and Birmingham areas. Sadly, postal deliveries to central Scotland are taking too long at the moment, so no more for me in the meantime. But I noticed that you can order a box for the food bank in Coventry. Good quality, fresh bread. Wouldn't that be a lovely gift for someone living in the margin? And one of the most difficult aspects of the fight against COVID-19 is the need to isolate and stay away from relatives in hospital at the very time when we most want to be there with them. In November 2017, I spoke to Alison Bunce of Compassionate Inverclyde, whose services include back-home boxes for people leaving hospital who live on their own, containing the means to make a simple meal and a cuppa and a handcrafted blanket. Now, they've turned their hand, along with some other local community groups, to providing self-isolation boxes for people who are particularly vulnerable. And they've also been appealing for nightwear for people being admitted to hospital. Normally, this would be provided by relatives, of course, as would bringing clothes to go home. And the local community is responding generously. As a strapline says, ordinary people helping ordinary people. As I said before, there are thousands of small voices around the world responding to a new need by doing what they can, offering their time, their talents, their money. From donating a pair of pyjamas to creating life-saving equipment, it all makes a difference to the person who benefits. Small voice, big impact. To quote Jim Estill again, I saw a need and I thought I could help. Well, you can. On some scale, it's within anyone's reach.
Thanks, Margaret. We're hoping to get an interview update from Proof Bakery and put that out as a podcast extra soon. Margaret also wanted us to mention that there's a new initiative to encourage people to donate or raise funds for charities. It follows from the cancellation of the London Marathon, which was going to be on the 26th of April, and it's called the 2.6 Challenge. It aims to raise what the London Marathon would have delivered, £67 million. Anyway, a wee plug for checking out www.2.6challenge.co.uk to find out more and support our charities. We'll have another small voice of the month for you next time, and please remember that we'd love to hear your suggestions for people or organisations to feature. Contact us via our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or on Twitter at small_voice1. Now for some more music, this time from Sally Simpson, and a couple of tunes she recorded specially for us a couple of weeks ago after coronavirus lockdown, creating a fab video in the safety of her own home. Some of you may have already seen it on our Facebook page. If not, go and have a look. During this difficult time, we want to support and help the musicians who have contributed to our podcast over the years. So, okay, we're doing what we're calling tunes from quarantine or songs in the key of lockdown. You get the idea. We hope you enjoy the music. And if you do, please consider supporting our music guests by making a purchase from them. Anyway, these are the tunes from Sally Simpson, Mrs. Jameson's favourite, and a Gaelic reel called The Reel of the Brown-Haired Girl. Was Sally Simpson with tunes recorded specially for us during lockdown. Be sure to check out Sally's website and Facebook page for details about the CDs and tunes she has available to buy. We will have lots of new music popping up on our Facebook page and on SoundCloud in this special quarantine series. Music from Paul Brown, Iona Fife, Margaret McLarty, the Daddy Naggins, well, half of them. So listen and watch out. These folks are just fab. Time for our moral mixdown. Now, obviously, there's something that we could talk about. It would be very easy. and I guess quite appropriate to talk about COVID-19, to talk about coronavirus. But what we thought we would do is actually look back over Easter in particular, because you'll know, faithful listener, that we put out quite a few bonus podcasts in Lent and then just in Easter week. And we recorded them before lockdown, so we didn't know at that time that we wouldn't be in our church buildings doing church services. So we thought, well, why not just talk about how the Easter experience has been at this somewhat strange time? So, Holly, do you want to start us off? How's it been?
So our church has jumped on the Zoom wagon quite quickly. So from the first Sunday that we weren't able to meet, we have been meeting for worship virtually on Zoom, which means that we can all see each other's faces, which has been fantastic, and trying to do some creative things with our worship. So by the time Holy Week rolled around, I think we were sort of getting into the swing of things, and we decided to have a series of short services for the evenings of Holy Week. So from the Monday to the Wednesday, we led some short reflections. So I led one, our minister led one, Anne led one. And then on the Thursday of Holy Week, on Maundy Thursday, we had a Zoom Tenebrae. So I was listening back to our Good Friday service, and I spoke about our Good Friday podcast that we made. Yeah. And I talked a little bit about a Tenebrae service that had meant a lot to me as a teenager, that it was something quite mystical as we extinguished a series of candles during the course of the service and all left the service in silence and in darkness. And we attempted to do that on Zoom on Maundy Thursday, which meant that each of us changed our names on Zoom to be the disciple who we were representing with our candles. And as we each blew out our candles, we also turned off our video on Zoom so that the screen got progressively darker during the course of the evening, which I thought worked really well. So that was how my Holy Week started. Were you anything for Holy Week, Darren?
Yes, it's actually interesting. You mentioned the Maundy Thursday, and my church, St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Portobello, had a Maundy Thursday service. Like Kim, yours, Holly and Anne, we've kind of jumped on the Zoom bandwagon as well. And I have to say, it's just been so great. I think we've said this before, seeing people and having that kind of contact and working out how to do the chat with each other before and after. But we did do a Maundy Thursday service. I have to confess that we were sat exactly where I am just now, you know, sat in front of the computer up in quite a nice room that's got a view out onto the street. And the Maundy service started at, I can't remember, let's say it was 7 or 7.30. And it was still going strong at 8 o'clock when there started to be this noise of clanging and banging out in the street. And for people listening to the podcast who are not in the UK, it's become a tradition in this short time of coronavirus for people on a Thursday evening at 8 o'clock to go out and clap the carers and the key workers, you know, the people in the NHS in particular, to clap in recognition of the fabulous job that they're doing. So I found myself sat here while this was going on outside, and at the same time we were at that point in the service where it was meant to be getting quiet and you were meant to be leaving peacefully. And I guess it's the advantage of everyone being on mute that no one could hear that. Confronted with that moral quandary, I must confess that we went out onto the balcony and we just started clapping. And when we came back, it was over. So that was by no means a perfect thing, although it felt important to us to be out there seeing our neighbours and clapping. But I think that's maybe something that I'm kind of learning about myself through this Lenten time, is that, you know, and you've mentioned this, Holly, before, I think, stop searching for the perfect service, for the perfect experience, and just kind of make sure that you live through the experience that you are having. And I think I found that in even this week, in some of the daily readings that I've been doing, there's been a lot about the Israelites going out of Egypt and things like Passover and how important it was to make sure that there was the right branch and it was hyssop and oil and so many different things that you had to do. I was almost reminded of the holy hand grenade of Antioch in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And I was reading that and thinking that's almost as bad as myself thinking that there's all these things that you have to do in order to have the perfect Easter service. So yeah, if that's an answer. Yeah, and also we had the service on Easter Sunday as well, which, you know what, we've discussed Easter Sunday before, you know, it was fine. What about you, Anne? I'm conscious you will have overlap with Holly here.
Well, yes, of course, we experienced these things together, but the one thing Holly didn't refer to was the Good Friday vigil. And I was really struck when I listened to the podcast that we did for Good Friday by how completely lacking in any foresight I was, because when you asked me how would I feel about a Good Friday vigil on my own, I said, oh no, that would never do. You have to be with people. And then, of course, we all got to experience, in one sense, Good Friday on our own. But of course, as Holly said, one of the things that we've discovered about the technology that we're using, Zoom in particular, is that you don't feel as if you're on your own. Even though nearly everyone who came into that vigil on Zoom opted not to use video, so all we saw were names, you still had a sense of people being around you and with you in that experience, that none of us was alone on Good Friday. And that meant a huge amount to me, although it happened in a way that I could never have anticipated. And as you said, Darren, we make our questions about Easter Sunday our speciality, really. And I drew the short straw this year and found myself on the rota to lead prayers for others on Easter Sunday. And I am so grateful to our minister who, at the beginning of the service and all the way leading up to those prayers, set a tone for that service that let us be authentic, you know, let us be real, because it would have been impossible for me to pray a kind of triumphalist Easter morning set of prayers on that particular Sunday. And so often that's what I think Christians feel compelled to do. And I know why they do. I know why they do it, because they're frightened that if they don't, people will think they don't believe in the resurrection. But that's not so. It's possible to understand that there are still people living in Good Friday and Holy Saturday, and yet to profoundly believe in the resurrection. And I was trying to think how I would explain it to somebody if they questioned the way that I led those prayers. There is nothing that could shake my belief in the resurrection now, because I hold it at a level of my DNA. It's something at the atomic level in me. It's not something that I'm persuaded of or someone has talked me into or could talk me out of. So that is something which is absolutely, utterly rock solid. But if you've got even the tiniest degree of empathy as to how other people might be feeling on that day, you can't leap up and be triumphalist, because, you know, if you look at that kind of, you know, great arc of history, so many people are still way down that arc in terms of achieving justice or in terms of knowing the peace and the hope of Easter. And so you have to kind of enter into their lives and walk Easter Sunday in their shoes, I think. And I am just so grateful to our minister for letting us do that and be that on Easter Day.
So Holly, were you involved in that service as well in terms of leading, or...?
I wasn't leading on Easter Day, actually. Having led much of the services in the run-up, I experienced Easter in exactly the same way that I said that I planned to experience Easter. I got up very early in the morning and I took myself for my government-sanctioned exercise up to a small park that is on the road where I live. And I listened to the bird song and I read the gospel narratives and I walked back along the road and I had a message on Twitter from my friend Steve, who had shared a picture of his wife Jelly, who is an Anglican priest, leading the Easter vigil in their garden, in a strappy top and what looked like a homemade stole, and her dreads piled on top of her head. And as I found out later, trying to get the cat to stop drinking the holy water. And I stood outside my front door and I wept, because I think I feared that I somehow wouldn't experience the resurrection if I didn't experience it with other people. But I think if you can't see the parallels between some of what happens in the gospel narrative and the way that we're living just now, then you're not reading it. I was struck in our main act of worship on Easter Day that Jesus made himself known to his friends in their own home in the breaking of bread, in the Emmaus story. And that was one place that I really found Easter this year, I guess. It was weirdly normal. I went for a walk, I had a bacon sandwich, I went to church, had a bit of a weird afternoon. But that's what Easter is. And unusually, because of the miracles of the internet, I got to go to church on Easter Sunday with my mum and my granny, yeah, and my mother-in-law, who are in Belfast and in Kent. And that's something that I've not been able to do for many years, and that meant an awful lot as well. So there are dreadful things about what's happening just now, but there are also wonderful things about what's happening just now. And that was really lovely to be able to see my granny singing along to Easter hymns with me. Was fab.
Yeah, you get that sense, don't you, of and I think people are saying that, you know, we mustn't go back to what we were before. You know, as awful as this is, there are some key things that we're learning, and we do well to kind of hold them precious. And I think for churches, that's been a real learning curve for them, and quite profound in ways that I wouldn't have predicted. I think particularly even just the use of technology, I would not have expected churches to have been all over this in the way that they have. It does not matter what age you are. You know, I will say that St. Mark's is not a particularly young congregation, but by heck, they're all there, be it with an iPhone or an iPad or whatever. They're somehow there and online.
Yeah, absolutely. I think seeing how important the community of the church is to people, that we are pulling together, that there were more people at our Holy Week vigils than I've ever seen at a face-to-face Holy Week vigil, because people recognise that this is a time when we really need each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's really special.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I would say now that it would be great to hear from our listeners, you know, for their experiences of Easter. And please do that. But I'm aware that many of you have been kind of engaging with us on social media about what you've had through Lent. So it would be great to hear from you. And maybe just some thoughts for kind of ways ahead for the church, as we now wind our way forward into the next bit of the Christian calendar. It's a journey of discovery for me, because I've not really done the kind of prayers through the year thing. So what's up next? I don't know. I think it's we're still in Easter.
No. Lots of Easter, Darren. Lots of Easter.
Is there a fair bit of Easter? How long?
Oh, ages.
Yeah. It will see me through the next 3 weeks. That's great.
Look out for Pentecost. Whoa. That'll give you a clue.
Yeah, okay. Our technical team are flashing fingers at me, so I think it's maybe quite a long time. Okay, that's great. Lovely to hear those experiences. Well, faithful listener, we've made it to the end of the show once more. I have to say, it's a bit weird recording the podcast in separate locations, but on the plus side, I have been able to see Holly's cat, Skye, cleaning herself very thoroughly. We're delighted that you've been able to join us once again, and we look forward to keeping you company next month as well. Meantime, there's plenty to keep you busy. You can visit our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or follow us on Twitter at @small_voice1, or subscribe to the show on iTunes, or visit our Facebook page, or why not check out our new TikTok page? Okay, I'm lying about that one. I just wanted to see the reaction it would get from our producer. So until next month, stay safe, stay strong.